Grave Tone.
Welcome to Grave Tone Podcast, where horror comes to life in every form it takes. I'm Megan.
I'm Arthur.
Welcome, everyone. We have today an interview with a very cool horror author, which we always love to have on our podcast, especially when they also send us a giant book. Thank you very much for sending this. It is ginormous, but it's so cool.
This is an audio podcast, so nobody can see this. I know, but I'm currently holding up a very, very, very large tome of six volumes of a horror fantasy epic. So
Horror fantasy epic by the name of Nightmareland. I mean, there is a bunch of names that are
in it. Each individual story has
names. Exactly. But today we are talking with the author, Daniel Barnett. Welcome.
Nice to be on with you too. Appreciate you. I mean, taking the time to, you know, sit down and have a chat with me about the book and whatever else.
Absolutely. Thank you for hopping on with us. I guess to kick things off for everyone listening, can you maybe walk us through what Nightmareland is? Because obviously this omnibus that we have received has six volumes in it, which is all that you have published thus far. I know that there's a seventh one that's already written, but this will be dropping September 1st, I believe, from what we've seen. And so if you want to kind of give people maybe a walkthrough of sort of what Nightmareland is and where it came from and what the premise of all of it is.
So Nightmareland, first and foremost, is a big series spanning a darkened America. One of the little kind of log lines, tag lines that I use for it is one man's journey to reach his estranged daughter in a world claimed by eternal night. But even that is not entirely fully accurate. It's also a story of found family. I've in the past, you know, described it as the Dark Tower meets The Last of Us.
Nice.
And specifically the games there. I'm kind of a game purist when it comes to that particular story. But what I mean by that is we're looking at a really intimate story between a mostly small cast of characters on against the backdrop of a great and terrible adventure. In this case, one where, you know, the sun appears to be gone. And it takes a little while to, you know, unfold all the way, but we do get to a point in time where, you know, places are populated by the nightmares that people have left behind, like literal manifestations of. So it's this big sandbox of horrors and kind of, you know, some of it can be a little bit fantastical, but I like to think that it stays pretty realistically grounded in terms of a couple people across this, heading out across this new unknown of a darkened America.
All right. Wow, that's a very interesting premise. I very like that. Would you say, I guess from what I understand, it is much more horror than fantasy, right?
Yeah, I think when I describe it as when I say horror fantasy, it might be a little semantic or whatever, but I consider it has fantasy conventions.
Yeah,
strong fantasy conventions. You have a group that's on a quest, you know. So, the bones are there. You might even have an element of, well, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's this kind of, this is maybe a broader discussion, but like a lot of Stephen King's work, for instance, has strong fantasy conventions. It has, you know, like the chosen children against the great evil. But, you know, it, of course, first and foremost, there might be some fantasy bones in the house, but the architecture surrounding it is all horror. And that's primarily what you see with this. It's a work of suspense, I guess you could say, simply. And there's certainly psychological horror, and then there's more overt, you know, nasties, that kind of stuff. And it's a lot of fun, I think.
For sure. And I mean, when you said it is Dark Tower mixed with The Last of Us, I'm already curious about it. I love the Dark Tower. I read all of it and I completely devoured it. It's one of my favorite Stephen King works.
So I'm a big Dark Tower fan, and in this case, one of the elements that, you know, defines Nightmareland is, well, John Hawthorne belongs to the kind of same general archetype that Roland mm-hmm. belongs to, and mm-hmm. he has his own Dark Tower that he's pursuing, and it's his daughter's okay. blue house by the Atlantic Ocean. It's a different, you know, obviously it's a different kind of Dark Tower, but it is still fundamentally a destination to be reached at all right. costs.
That's very cool. So when you were, I guess, starting to write it, because it has such a large scope, I guess, mm-hmm. from what I understand of the story, did you kind of like have this massive idea in mind when you started, or was it just kind of like developing over time and becoming bigger?
Yeah, did you always know it was going yeah. to be yeah. as large as it's become?
Well, I think it's hard to know just how large anything's going to be when you kind of know it's going to be big from the get-go. Like, I knew it was going to be big. I originally thought 10 volumes. But yeah, I mean, it has absolutely surprised me along the way. The story has grown. The characters have grown. Events at the end of volume 6. So I guess maybe I should preface this a little bit by saying it's not kind of... I didn't put these first 6 volumes together because I had 6 volumes. I put these first 6 volumes together because this is a really well-defined arc in the series. Volume 6, Lily, is a big season finale, so to speak, for everything that's come so far. It wraps up a lot of plot arcs. It's packed with, like, devastating consequences, and the series moving forward from Lily, you know, picks up where Lily left off. This is one right. big continuous mm-hmm. story, but it also is something of a new beginning. Things will look different going forward after Lily, for sure. So I didn't necessarily always know that, you know, that it was going to be exactly this way, but you have sometimes, I think, going into something like this, landmarks along the way, and then they become a little more clearly defined, and then they kind of move around a little bit potentially.
Yeah,
you have these places that you know you're coming to, and some of the path is a little bit, you know, obscured, so to speak. And then when you get to that part, you think, you know, okay, it's going to be 2 miles through the woods here. And it turns out that it's 10 miles and not just woods, but a swamp too, you know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of maybe another way of saying that, yeah, I have ideas about things going forward, but I like to leave enough flexibility to honor the story where it's at. I think that's really important, to leave enough flexibility in the narrative to let it surprise you and like kind of like mm-hmm. grow and twist organically. If everything is so set in stone, then, you know, it's hard. That sense of surprise, I think when you're surprised as an author, it's oftentimes when the reader might be too, you know.
That's it.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, that's it. So it allows you to kind of explore your own creation in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, people talk about like writing books and stuff, how it's like ultimately kind of like a selfish act. I think, you know, we're writing this for me first and foremost. I'm trying to tell right. the best version of the kind of story that I would want to read, or the best that I can, you know, mm-hmm. that I can manage. But, you know, and yeah, in any case. That's nice. Nightmareland so far. I'm excited about it.
Definitely. I mean, it sounds definitely very interesting. And from what I understand, you have 12 planned. Is that correct?
Yeah, 12.
In total. Okay.
Yeah. So, this omnibus represents the first half of the series. I don't know if that's gonna, you know, what that's gonna look like in terms of word count by the mm-hmm. time it's done.
Sure.
But, it started off as a bit of a serialized kind of project. Some of the first volumes are a little bit shorter, and mm-hmm. different reasons for that sort of thing. You know, I wanted each part in the book to have, you know, its own strong, or each volume to have its own beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
You know, a feeling of kind of completeness. I wasn't just like writing a story and then chopping it arbitrarily so I could, you know, sell right. it, sell more, you know, whatever. I approached it that way. And, you know, for people who wanted the serialized bite-sized format and for people who still want the serialized bite-sized format, it does still exist in that format.
Oh, nice.
Daniel Serra's lovely artwork is still out there, you know, with paperback books and on Kindle editions. And, you know, you can get each book separately and read it that way. But I also felt I love a doorstopper. I mean, I love a doorstopper, and I felt that it worked really well in that format too. And I wanted both kinds of readers to have the option to, you know, to enjoy the story in the way that they want to. And I want people who are fans of the series to have this kind of a, I like to, you know, like, I think it's a lot went into this book. Leslie Q did 6 wonderful illustrations mm-hmm. that will be in yeah. both the Kindle edition and in the hardcover edition. And it is, I mean, it is, they did such wonderful work. Daniel Serra very graciously for the hardcover edition allowed us to use the original artwork as backgrounds for each title yeah. chapter page in the book. So you get his incredible artwork, and I mean, he's a World Fantasy Award winner or British Fantasy Award winner, probably both. My apologies, I don't remember all that he's won, but he's done a lot of wonderful stuff. You know, he's worked on the Hellraiser comics and Tommy Knockers special edition for King and a whole bunch of stuff. But Todd Kiesling put it all together in this beautiful format. It's a big, expensive book due to the requirements of selling a book. It's like $22 just to print.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, shop talk would entail me talking about how, you know, retailers demand 55% off of every copy. And long story short is it's $54. And to purchase in stores, mm-hmm. I'll make $1, you know, or $1.30.
Yeah.
You know, like that was like the minimum price I could set it at.
Right.
To like not be in the negative almost. So, it's something I wanted to share something beautiful with people, you know, for people mm-hmm. who like this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fantastic also that people are going to get, because we've been looking through that's at the artwork in the book, and it's really fantastic. It's so beautifully done. I think it's wonderful that people who are purchasing the copy digitally are going to be able to have access to it as well. You know, because some people just accessibility wise, right, don't necessarily have the opportunity to pick up an edition like this in the first place. So it's great that they're going to have the option to actually still be able to view all the hard work that was put into the artwork for all of this as well. That's really cool.
Thank you. I'm very excited about it. And on that note, you know, this is the most affordable edition if you read it on the Kindle edition, because I think I have it priced at $11.99 or something like that.
Wow.
But that's, you know, like if you bought the whole series all the way through, it'd be like $26 or $27.
Right.
So this is quite a markdown in terms of the, you know, that kind of cost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the omnibus is probably, you know, is still ultimately cheaper than getting each individual paperback as well.
Right.
I can't say it's like, it is something of a luxury item still, but you know, it's all there in one and it's beautiful and I'm quite proud of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's amazing. Speaking of the artwork that we were just talking about, did you have kind of like any steer in the way that you've that the artwork was done, in a sense of like,
did they just kind of roll with it?
Yeah, like, I mean, did you have any direction to it? Did you want to have direction into it, or you just kind of like let them freehand it?
So Leslie's wonderful. And it was my intention to find the thing that I wanted the most going into, you know, finding somebody to illustrate this book was I wanted somebody who was willing to read the book. And then I wanted to give them the freedom to essentially illustrate what they wanted from it. So we had kind of a way of going about it where they would read a volume, and it took place over 11 months. They'd read a volume and they'd say, I'm interested in illustrating A, B, or C, or A or B, or whatever along those lines. And I might help them narrow it down, but ultimately it was really important to me because I think that the best work is done like by an artist when they're, you know, excited to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to give them free rein and, you know, just kind of like let them, like I went to them for a reason, you know, I trust you. I love your work. Like, and I think they just did a phenomenal job. I think they did an absolutely phenomenal job with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome.
It's and they did the cover. They did the cover too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
And no, it's great too, because I'm sure that it's not always the case that that's it necessarily. An artist can or has the time to read the work as well in order to like really get into that level of inspiration for it and really understanding what the story is. So it's cool because it obviously lends itself very well to the finished product that way.
Yeah, it's my experience that it's kind of more the exception to the rule that the artist reads the book. Granted that probably, you know, that there's a lot of circumstantial reasons that might change.
Right.
But generally, I think, you know, you're speaking to the artist about, at minimum, a mood or a feeling or some key points or something like that, or more often, you know, coming to them with an idea for the cover. But it really depends. And my, you know, take my experience with a grain of salt. I have published a fair number of books at this point, and that's been the case for me, but I'm sure there's a lot of exceptions.
Awesome. Speaking of, that's it, the volumes, I suppose, and the amount of volumes within the series as a whole. Out of curiosity, do you already have an ending in mind, or might it change depending on how things go?
Oh, I've had an ending in mind for quite a while. I think I know most, most of it, but like I have, that's one of the big landmarks, you know, and that's one of the reasons that volumes 7 and 8, the first volumes in the second part of the series have taken me longer. there's other reasons, like, you know, just like life reasons, but the way the story has grown through the first 6 and the way my kind of mental process works with stuff like this, a story like this doesn't grow linearly for me. It's kind of like, you know, a garden, I guess you could say. So some days you're over here working on like the tomatoes, and and another days you're on the rutabaga over there, and you know, you might like, you might be planting something that's like not gonna like come to fruition for a while, you know, like you're just sort of doing a lot of different kinds of small things that will grow over time. And so when I say that I like to leave flexibility for things to come to pass, I also am writing with an awareness of certain endpoints or potential endpoints, things of that nature. You know, there's a character that gets introduced in volume 7 whose introductory line for their chapter is going to potentially mirror a final line for that character. I'm being really coy about it, but kind of like the more intricate things get, you know, there's just a lot of like little considerations to make along the way, a lot of little things to grow, and a lot of little things where I guess what I'm trying to say is ultimately I'm not a total pantser, but but I still sort of emulate that a little bit. It's kind of like it's hard to describe. I don't really even fully understand it myself, but I do know going into the second half of this series more than I did into the first half.
Yeah.
Just how much these little things that are planted at the beginning can grow at the end. I consider Lily to be the best book that I've ever written. I think Lily is kind of the book that I set out to write when I set out to write at the very beginning. Like, it's the book right. that I wanted to write.
Okay.
Yeah, so you end up in this kind of situation where, you know, you just want to kind of get the first, like, parts, especially the soil right.
Yeah.
And everything mm-hmm. kind of planted. And then you also sort of might write with, like, in mind that you can change things a little bit as long as you get to it before something's published. But mm-hmm. there's a key thing in the first six books that there's a certain lullaby. I don't know if either of you have read any part of it so far, but the lullaby belonged to someone else initially. And one day, a couple years after having started the series, I went, oh, it actually fits a lot better if it came from somewhere else. And then that became, and then it became, like, much, you know, kind of more important.
Yeah.
Or significant because of the, like, slight change of initial ownership. Yeah. Anyway, like, I'm being coy because I don't want to spoil. Like,
that's fair.
Know, yeah, no, that's fair.
Yeah, that's it. It sounds like, at least to me, that you have, like, a physical board with strings attached to everything to make sure that the story relates and makes sense. And like you said, the things that are planted are, you know, growing in the right direction, also not impacting other things. Is that something you have, like, physically, or is it just in your head on a spreadsheet?
It's in my head, and I have, okay. like, a couple side documents where I just throw things sometimes. Yeah. But, it's a weird thing where, again, I feel like it's really important to at least sort of maintain. It's kind of like almost a superstitious thing. Like, the mm-hmm. amount of stuff I don't write down because I don't want it to feel too concrete.
Right.
But at the same time, I might, or like, for instance, there's a couple lines at the end of, like, at the end of six that are just like these big, big lines for these characters, you know, and I didn't write them down like I was going to be scared to forget them. I let them kind of, like, burn in me for years. So by the time I got to them, writing them down for the first time was like this reward. It was like, today I get to write this thing that I know I'm going to write, you know, it kind of creates its own, like, very intense, intimate sort of private reward system, I think, sometimes. But I also, like, you know, just how my brain is, I guess.
That's fair. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. It's, I don't know if I would be able to keep all that straight in my head.
Yeah, I don't
you know.
I need more of, like, a system
to
keep track of everything.
For sure. So you did mention that, you know, The Last of Us is one of the, I guess, influences or something that you, I guess, you played, obviously, right? Or watched TV shows and stuff. How much would you say that kind of, like, influence? Because I'm hearing a lot of themes, right? The kind of, like, the family building the dread and everything, like.
Yeah. So, in some ways, accidentally, like there's fans of The Last of Us will potentially, you know, especially the comparison is drawn, note that both stories, you know, feature a brother in Wyoming. Okay. That wasn't even, like, entirely, you know, that wasn't even, like, a conscious, like, kind of homage or anything.
Right.
It sort of kind of came to be that way. But definitely The Last of Us 2, the sort of revenge odyssey of The Last of Us 2
mm-hmm.
became very, you know, like you said, the dread, that became kind of a crucial part of volume six.
Right.
Just the feeling of the thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like not all the ways are, like, really, like defined ways, but I guess the biggest one is really setting this kind of, just this like the intimacy of the storytelling. You know, it might at some points have like a bigger cast, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't think it loses the feeling of we're here with this small group of people that we love as they brave like untold dangers.
Yeah.
You know, cling to what's there, you know, that kind of thing. That was something that I thought, while not necessarily unique to The Last of Us, was kind of crystallized in The Last of Us in a way that was really special and very cinematic. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I mean, there's that whole joke or not joke about how pretty much everybody writing, you know, any kind of adventure, any kind of fantasy is just trying to recapture the feeling that Tolkien gave us with the Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And I mean, in that kind of fundamental sense too, that's what I'm talking about when I say that like Nightmareland has its, you know, fantasy conventions, is it's the same, you know, it's a quest. The goals and the reasons for the quest might change along the way. Or not necessarily, or like the motivating forces for you know, what they're doing might grow along the way. But at the end of the day, it's a story about, you know, some like a group of people like being brave enough to take another step when the way forward is dark. There's a deaf character that's one of the main characters. He's a 13-year-old son of a son of a woman whose own parents were immigrants abducted by the state. And his deafness actually affords him a unique strength or defense against some of the things that are going on here. And of course we have our kind of hard-bitten hero with, you know, like a long history that, you know, we eventually get to. And then there's a woman named Maria or Mariah, depending on, you know, the pronunciation of that name is going to haunt me forever. But, you know, was once or maybe still is a something of a love interest with the main character, but a uniquely strong personality and just person. And again, just some this trio, this small found family that forms a bond against this backdrop of really just like lasting darkness and like untold terrors, you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Something that like was, I mean, it's meant a lot to me. I mean, these characters feel very real to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that is very cool. It sounds like very personal, and obviously it's going to have a lot of emotional depth. If you said that it makes you feel like the season two of The Last of Us at the beginning, my God.
Yeah.
We cried, like, you know, yeah. No spoilers there, but you know what it is. So that's amazing. Speaking of, you know, the everlasting darkness and the horrors that are in this universe, we have a couple of, so we have like a fun question.
Yeah.
To wrap things up in a sense. So two-part question, right? So first of all, how long do you think you would last in your own universe of Nightmareland? And what would be the one object you would grab?
On your way out the door.
On your way out the door.
Oh gosh, not very long, most likely. you know, that's a little bit of a complicated question because there's some circumstances that change. And depending on where you're located, kind of gives you an advantage or not. I don't know that I would go. So that's I'd take my dog and I'd run. I don't know.
Okay.
or I take my dog and I go hide somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's that bad.
So it would be like, well, it would be more of like a try to last through it as opposed to fight against it kind of thing.
If you can, this is a world where if you can get somewhere remote, you might have a chance.
Okay, yeah.
Barring one particular like thing that I'm not gonna spoil.
Yeah,
for sure.
Because there's something of a before and after effect that takes place. And in the midst of that, survival is almost initially down to chance because there's a danger that you just can't see coming, and unless you're removed from all of the potential sources of it, it's probably, it has to do with why Marcos's deafness was a key protecting factor.
That's it, I figured. Okay. So. Also in line with that would be interesting, what would be like the best strength of a character who would, I guess, survive the best? Or would you say it would be like physical strength, psychological strength? I don't know.
A particular characteristic.
Yeah, that's it. Well, or it's just like, you need to have everything.
I think the ability to endure and hold on to hope in a world like this one is probably the most defining characteristic. And I think that kind of gets into something that's a strong like thematic underpinning for the series, which is there's a line in volume 6 that I see getting quoted in reviews and stuff of like around that, and it's a character speaking to Marcos, and it's roughly something like, all the best stories have hope, Marcos, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. And that's fundamentally kind of what I believe, you know. So I'm not writing this without hope for the future.
Yes.
But it is a long, dark road.
That's good. I think it makes a lot of sense when it's very dark all around you. Hope is probably your best weapon for survival in general.
In the same, I mean, obviously you've taken inspiration from multiple, you know, different things as well as your own ideas for the series and everything. Growing up, did you have favorite horror properties, whether they were films or books or stuff in particular?
My favorite novel of all time is the original version of The Stand. And I think that a lot of what I really love about storytelling is encapsulated there. I read pretty widely from a pretty young age, but it was for so many other horror authors, Stephen King, who introduced me to the kind of story that I wanted to tell, which is the kind where you take, you know, believable real characters and put them in extraordinary circumstances and forge them into something new. Sometimes it's something greater and sometimes it's something lesser, but it's the most like kind of like foundational and interesting and like deeply emotional kind of like function of storytelling. I guess. And the way he did that was eye-opening and opening in other ways too. So I was a huge scaredy cat as a kid. Like I couldn't, I mean, I had trouble like the dark, you know, all the way up to like high school. And then somewhere along the way, like the switch flipped and it became like an obsession instead of you know, so I watched everything scary that I possibly could. I read everything scary that I possibly could. And it became something that, like, I had, like, I at least had, like, an equal stake of ownership with, you know, instead of it just, like, being, like, this thing that could rule me and ruin me, you know, scary stuff. When I was 2 years old, I went to my dad's house, and I was like talking about the Cookie Monster, and he was like, "You want to see a real monster, son?" And he made me watch Legend with Tom Cruise.
Oh my god!
And yeah, my mom was pissed. I apparently didn't sleep in my room for like months.
I bet.
Yeah, Tim Curry back. I mean, like classic Tim Curry at 2 years old was. Whew,
too much for anybody, I would think. That's a lot.
Yeah. But you listen to my dad, and he'll tell you he doesn't like horror, but like he's the one who introduced me to all of it. You know what I mean? It's just
there you go.
He doesn't like to think of himself as somebody who likes horror. That's kind of the key to, that's the kind of key distinction.
Sometimes generationally there is a stigma around it being seen as lesser than as a genre to a degree, as though it's just slop and it doesn't really have anything interesting to say other than to provide sort of cheap thrills for people going to the movie theater and things like that. There's all sorts of, particularly older generations, where like there's a lot of stigma sort of around that. And I think that now, you know, especially in a year like this where we're getting like a ton of stuff that is being critically lauded, we're seeing many changes happen, you know, both through like major awards shows and things like that, as well as through the type of horror that's being released, whether it's fiction or film or television or whatever the case may be. So I think we're seeing a big difference that way now.
There's another saying, and I agree with you. Like, I think that it's horror is having more than its moment in the mainstream. And I've always believed that it could be mainstream because I'm aping somebody else's, you know, I think somebody said, you know, horror is a big house.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So like there's a room in there for everyone. It's like comedy, you know, you might not want to sit down and watch like Van Wilder, but you know, like you probably enjoy, you know, some form of comedy out there at some form of time.
Absolutely.
Horror is very, very fundamentally the same as that. There's, you know, it's just if you have horror, so many of our favorite stories have horror. It's about a measure of how much, where, when, and also contrasting elements in the story that define whether or not, you know, it's like is if you put like how much sugar do you need to put in water before it's not water anymore?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, horror is like one of the most foundational genres, emotions, everything. And then it can be used to evoke sorrow, could be used to evoke horror, obviously, and terror, you know, things of that nature. But it cannot, like, it's a wonderfully strong defining element by contrast, I think. I find that like the emotional resonance in a story that takes you to the hardest, darkest places rings that much clearer and sharper and brighter by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing I think that like comes forward in The Last of Us. Like, I don't know if you've played the games.
A little bit. I watched the playthroughs and then we watched obviously the whole TV show.
Yeah.
I would like so highly recommend watching the entire Let's Play for like the second game in particular.
Yeah.
It is like night and day next to the TV show, in my opinion. And it again has those moments where like this just like such a striking moment of beauty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Backdropped against or against the backdrop of something like that's so emotionally hard or whatever else. And there's a reason it's like one of my favorite stories for sure.
that makes total sense. I agree with you and everything you said. It's very true. I mean, sounds like The Last of Us is definitely a recommendation of yours. Give us another couple of few recommendations of books or movies, like personal recommendations?
Gosh, I have a ton. I've of course mentioned the original version of The Stand. If you've never read the original version of The Stand, I highly recommend it. It's a little harder to find, but it's totally worth it. I just read The Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb. I just finished it this morning. The tears are still drying. I'm like not even joking. I cried. It was like you want to talk about a brutal world that's instilled with like surprising warmth and tenderness. A lot of people know Robin Hobb. She's phenomenal. That's a fantasy book, you know, through and through.
Yeah.
I have a particular affinity for the film Dr. Sleep.
So good.
It's great.
Yeah, I think that like that one almost makes up for what Kubrick did to The Shining back in the day. Actually it does for me. It's interesting.
Combines the best of both into like the strengths of both of those things from the Shining film and the novel, and takes them and then also seamlessly weaves them together into a new, very new type of story, because Dr. Sleep is a very different type of story than its predecessor. So,
and because Kubrick blew the ending of The Shining, the hotel still exists, which means that Dr. Sleep in the film version gets to have a much bigger climax.
Yes.
So
it's arguably better than the book that way a little bit, because you get to go back to the Overlook, which is
exactly. It's not just like a husk or something. There's a little bit of scaffolding or something.
It's very different.
Nice. Yeah. That's perfect. Awesome. So thank you so much for joining us. Can you just again let us know what the book is and where can people find it?
Yeah. So the book is The Nightmareland, it's called Nightmareland Volumes 1 through 6. Pre-order links will be going live very soon, and most, if not all of the usual places. The series as it stands is already available on Amazon and other places as well too, in terms of the individual volume format. Mm-hmm. And you can find me on Instagram at dbhfiction, as well as Facebook under my name. I'm on Threads. I had to leave Twitter a while back after it became
fair enough.
You can find me, type in my name in Nightmareland, and you're gonna find me. Daniel Barnett again is my name, so I know this is not a I know we can see each other right now, but viewers or listeners won't necessarily be able to. So
no, that's fair. Totally smart.
Great. Well, thank you so much for hopping on with us. This was really fun.
Yeah, I had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you.